Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to have a conversation with Dr. Bill Thomas, an award-winning author, a renowned speaker, and a visionary about ending the plague of loneliness and a new vision for aging.
I'm really excited about that, Christy. You know, one of the nice things about getting to work with you on a regular basis here at the radio show and all the people that we produce is I don't feel lonely when I'm here having these kinds of conversations.
And I don't either.
And
thank you for being good company, Adam.
Well, thank you. But I think this question of loneliness, though, is a really important characteristic question, because I think everyone feels lonely at lots and different points and times of their lives. And it doesn't feel great. We don't mind being alone at times, but to feel lonely, it means something else has changed. And I think that's something that we want to hear about. And maybe it happens to adults, children, grandparents. And he's got some great ideas.
He sure does. Well, we're looking forward to that conversation. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters about germs in public restrooms compared with your home.
That's gross, Christy.
Just gross.
About summer jobs as we come to think of the upcoming season. And if you're a teen and you get one, does it keep you out of trouble?
About a new breast cancer vaccine showing some promise.
And then what do we know about the HIV medications? And are we really making HIV less, or are we maybe making the disease more virulent because we're kind of blocking in the genetic mutations?
That sounds like a lot of big words, but we'll first start with germs in bathrooms.
Which is yuck. That's a nice simple word there, which is, okay, this is like fess up time, Christy. When we go into a restroom, do we think, there's a certain kind of grossness about being in a restroom, but we always going to wash our hands because we don't want to get germs. That part's true.
Yes. And as a mother, I mean, how many times going into a public restroom have I like tried to hold the kids over the toilet or trying to make sure they don't touch anything because of my feeling that these germs are really bad because we're in a public bathroom?
Yeah, I think that happens for both men and women.
It's like, try to avoid touching anything.
Well, this particular research, though, really is trying to find out, which is, I think, kind of an interesting question, is the germs that are in public restrooms, are they different than the germs that are just in your house? Which I would say, of course they're worse. They got to be a lot worse, right?
Right, right. And don't you wash your hands more often in public bathrooms than you do in your own bathroom? I probably would confess
to that. Not going to answer that one.
I know. Well, apparently, these researchers did research on four different public restrooms, two male and two female, just to keep it fair, in a camp. Now, granted, it was a campus building at San Diego State University. So it's not like being at the fast food joint or at a public restrooms on the highway. These were at two universities, but had all comers who came in and used the restroom.
And this research that was actually published in the journal Applied and Environmental Microbiology basically found that the levels of the things you'd be worried about, which would be bad bacteria that come from the colon, E. coli is one of them, really are not any significantly different in those environments, because the public restrooms, while you find them initially there, they're not a conducive area for a lot of things to grow, and they kind of go away pretty quickly.
Exactly. So they found just because restroom services are dry and don't have a lot of the resources that bacteria like to grow in, that really the same germs that you find in your home bathrooms were what were found in these public bathrooms.
And a lot of those are the ones that are on your hands, things called Staph aureus, that kind of common bacteria, and that the hand washing at home and at the restrooms are probably equally important, and we shouldn't discount one over the other. That doesn't mean we shouldn't
wash your hands.
Right. That doesn't mean we want to go into the restroom and not worry about things, but we probably shouldn't be overly worried.
That is right. Well, let's talk about summer jobs. I think this is a great bit of research published in the journal Science surrounding about 1,600 teenagers in the 8th to 12th grade that were from a particularly violent and poor neighborhoods in Chicago. looking to see the ones who participated in public summer jobs in this program, how that differed in their crime.
And about half of the teens participated in this public summer jobs program, and they might be working as camp counselors or community gardens, working in maybe people who work in the government. And, you know, some of them got counseling about how to maybe life skills and hopefully some mentoring, too. And the other half did not.
And what they found was a decrease. The students enrolled in this program were 43% less likely to be arrested for a violent crime. They found a decrease in nonviolent crime during that summer, but then they found a longer term, even after the summer ended, overall decrease in violent crime after the program ended, suggesting that it wasn't just about being in a job and staying off the streets, but that there was maybe something valuable about having a job that shaped these teenagers to stay away from violent crime. What do
now
you think?
This isn't a cause and effect study. This was not like a randomized trial where
sure.
we get half of them get the jobs, half of
right.
them don't. That might be kind of a little bit of an unethical study probably. And so I'm not sure we contribute, you know, there can be self-selection. Those who got the jobs were
sure.
more likely to, you know, to. There's lots of things you think that about that. But boy, this is a good story. It's like, okay, you're getting a job this summer. Did you have summer jobs growing up, Christy?
I had some summer jobs.
Like what?
One time I worked for this place at the Hop and had to wear those little 50s outfits. And,
at the Hop? Da-da.
Yeah, exactly. Like the little 50s place. I worked for an attorney one summer. Little things like that. But I did a lot of camps and a lot of school-related things and leadership development and all that stuff in my summers that kept me away from real jobs.
Yeah, I was playing sports, but also working in my dad's office and in a laboratory and just doing things. And I think that doing things is sometimes keeps you out of trouble, too. So,
was a scientist. I didn't know this.
A dentist, yes.
A dentist, okay.
Working in that laboratory with those dental models. Look at those smiles.
Wow, that explains your pretty teeth. Well, let's talk shifting gears to a vaccine for breast cancer. It doesn't tie in with your teeth, but
it does not.
Is something
but
that's
there is
positive.
It is some promise and positive. And, you know, we're always about trying to bring research that is on the cutting edge and positive. And this was a research that was in the journal Clinical Cancer Research. And it was really a preliminary results about the safety of a vaccine that might slow down progression of breast cancer.
And basically what they found was that at least in these 14 breast cancer patients, it was safe. And the preliminary results did show that it slows the cancer progression. And it does that by making the immune system or your body's ability to fight off germs to focus and destroy the cells that have this certain protein that's very common in breast cancers.
Called mammoglobin A.
Mammoglobin A.
Had not heard of it before, but it sounds like something that we would want to try to interact with. And they, interestingly enough, found a small study that the safety was okay, but the effectiveness was much greater than they anticipated.
Right.
So I think this is going to move into clinical trials. Not ready for prime time yet, but maybe not as far away as we can imagine. So
definitely
looking forward to that.
Hope.
Last research study real quickly is about HIV disease and progression to AIDS. And that whole progression for the 35 million Americans or people around the world who are living with HIV is really an important question.
Yeah, so we basically this was a study of 2,000 women with chronic HIV infection. Studies done by researchers at the University of Oxford with a lot of collaboration in different areas. And they were looking at how the virus changes or adapts to certain elements of a person's immune system. And there's something about how it adapts that then makes it what we call less virulent or less or slower to replicate and to turn into full-on AIDS.
This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And even though the body is doing different things with the genes and the virus is trying to adapt to overcome that, overall, the impact is this virulence, the viral, that's becoming less. And so as we're doing better with the drugs, as we're really trying to control this epidemic, there's actually lots of other things that are happening that are probably helping this process good news.
It is good news.
Research that matters.
Yes, it is. We've had a chance to talk about a slow of the ability of HIV to turn into AIDS.
About a real promise of a breast cancer vaccination, you know, in the next couple of years. We're looking forward to it.
About summer jobs being positive for teenagers and possibly contributing to keeping them out of trouble.
And we're going to wash our hands both in the bathroom and at home, but we're not going to be quite as worried as we were before.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Bill Thomas, author, speaker, visionary, about ending the plague of loneliness. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Bill Thomas, award-winning author, renowned speaker, and visionary spirit behind work to ending the plague of loneliness.
Welcome, Dr. Thomas. We're glad to have you.
Thanks for inviting me.
You know, you've had a remarkable history from Harvard to Rochester Family Medicine. You're a geriatrician. You've had just a remarkable path. But how did you become passionate about aging and about changing a paradigm to end loneliness?
You know, I, as you said, I kind of started my career on what some people would sort of think of the fast track of medicine. And initially, really imagined myself building a career in emergency medicine and being a hotshot that way. And I took a part-time job in a nursing home just by a fluke and wound up falling in love with the people and with the work. And the number one thing that opened my eyes was the recognition that I could do a lot of good because the system was so desperately in need of change. So I kind of changed my path in life and became a geriatrician and been happy ever since.
Well, we think you're a hot shot too, by the way. So, you know, you didn't have to give that up.
And you did that with mission
hot
and purpose.
Hot shot and geriatrician, they don't always go in the same time.
Well, you know, let's dive really right into nursing homes and assisted living centers and continuing care units. I went to visit a patient a couple weeks ago in an assisted living center, and I must say, and it's one that's almost all Medicaid, the patients that are there, and I must say, it appeared from the outset, even as a doctor coming in, that and it was one of the most depressing things I had seen. Everyone in there seemed so lonely and isolated. Tell us, how do you define loneliness, and what kinds of problems does it create?
Well, yeah, so that's an observation. Your observation is shared by millions of people, obviously. And if you want to really dig in and think about loneliness, it's really about the pain people experience when they want companionship but can't have it. So the irony of these buildings is that they're full of people. I mean, they are full of people, actually 24 hours a day, but they are among the loneliest places on earth because the presence of other people does not carry with it the guarantee of companionship. So early on in my career, I was taught, really by the elders I was taking care of, that if I wanted to make their life better, I needed to help them gain access to companionship.
And is that companionship, as you think about it, peer companionship? Is it companionship of young people or diverse interactions? How what is it that people need?
Well, actually, you put your finger on a really important point, is that in our medical system, we often try to pick one thing, like, oh, here's the answer. The answer is children. That's the answer. We got to get children in there. What we did instead was took a more ecological perspective, and we just said a simple thing. What if this was a garden? What if, you know, that nursing home you walked into? What if it was actually a garden And what if this garden was designed to grow people? What would it be like? And the first thing you realize is that you would need lots of different sources of companionship. So young children, yes. Dogs and cats and birds, rabbits and chinchillas, yes. Plants and gardens, yes. I mean, that the answer has to have many different parts in order for it to feel real and not contrived.
Well, you know, I know we're going to talk extensively about this alternative garden, this Eden alternative that you mm-hmm. and those you have brought around you work with. But I want to mm-hmm. ask, there are some health consequences. I mean, everyone would say loneliness is not a good thing. But mm-hmm. it's not the same thing as depression, but it seems like mm-hmm. they're related. And yet, also, it seems that it's tied to this concept of community. That it, you know, because we are in neighborhoods where we may be alone, even though we're surrounded mm-hmm. by people in neighborhoods. Right. Can you talk about those dual concepts of community, but also depression?
Yeah. So here's the thing I think in a lot of ways America has lost track of, and that is aging is a team sport. And if you want to do it well and you want to find joy in it, you have to be connected. So it's the connectedness that matters. And there, as you hinted at, there actually is an abundance of research that says that older people who connect to others, whether it's their neighbors or friends, family, companion animals, children, but whatever it is, elders who connect actually experience a better quality of life and have better health and better function than elders who are socially isolated. So I actually think of loneliness as a plague. It's a plague. And it's endemic in our country, and we actually have the means of combating that plague and wiping it out, and that is companionship and connectedness.
And so what factors lead to certain populations as they age being more disconnected from community and lonely compared with those who find themselves more or able to be intentionally connected to their churches or other facets mm-hmm. of their community?
Well, here's an irony that I stumbled upon in my years of work on this subject. The people who tend to be the most disconnected and the most lonely are the people who believe most firmly in the myth of independence. So America, as you know very well, really makes a big deal out of independence and really celebrates independence among its citizens, being on your own, stand on your own two feet. Well, it turns out that mythology is very damaging to people, and the people who accept it the most are the most likely to self-isolate from the community when they understand that they can't create an illusion of independence. The second thing that's really important about this is our American families are very different than they were one or two generations ago, and many older people are now living among strangers, not among family and friends. They're living among strangers because people have moved on, kids have grown up and moved away. And so it really requires an intentional effort to connect. Whereas in older times, your younger relatives would be all around you because they lived a mile away. Now, you really have to work to make these connections. And I think that's making the problem of loneliness worse.
You know, I'm thinking about my father, Dr. Thomas, and when he was alive and moving from his house to a more of a apartment, condo, group mm-hmm. setting sort of element, he was so resistant for this independence issue you raised. But I think there was also another factor, which is making new friends involves skills that we may or may not be prepared for. Mm-hmm. Help us mm-hmm. understand in your experience, maybe you have an example or two of mm-hmm. some folks you've worked with of where it didn't go as well as you liked, or maybe where it went really well.
Yeah, you know, you're right that making new friends, making new social relations is an energy-requiring process. And I actually got the best advice, possibly the best advice in my entire life from a 93-year-old woman who I was taking care of. And I knew her, and I knew that she had this wonderful circle of friends and that she was very always very bubbly and vibrant when I saw her in the office. So, of course, I had to ask her, what's the secret? And she said to me, life, your relationships in life are like a funnel. And as you go through your life and the years pass on, people fall out of the bottom of your funnel. You know, they pass away or they move or they get another job, they get remarried. They drop out of the bottom of your funnel. And if you don't make it a habit, keep putting new relationships in the top of the funnel, then when you get to be my age, 93, you'll find that you have no one left. And I just, you know, I know you guys know this feeling. You're sitting in the exam room in the office and somebody just told you something really wise. And I just sit back in my chair, you know, I'm sitting in the exam room, put my head against the wall and go, wow, that's what I need to do. So she actually gave me advice that I use in my life, which is keep filling the funnel.
That is, and it's a beautiful imagery as well. We hope that we know that we're going to carry on this conversation after we take a break. And I hope that you'll help us think about how to encourage people, as Adam was asking, to develop those skills if they're not like this woman, naturally inclined and very intentional about filling that funnel. Of how do you do that if you're out of practice or don't feel like you have the confidence or the skills to do it? We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with our guest, Dr. Bill Thomas, award-winning author, renowned speaker, and visionary, about ending the plague of loneliness. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Bill Thomas, author, speaker, and visionary, about ending the plague of loneliness. And just before we broke, Dr. Thomas, you really laid out this wonderful vision of a funnel where you have to keep refilling the funnel. You have to keep really developing friends and connections with people as a metaphor, and I just love that. And I wonder, you've really established something called the Eden Alternative that is a model with elderly to develop this sense of connectedness and help fill that funnel. Tell us about it and how you came about it and what's going on.
Well, one day I was making rounds at a nursing home as a physician, and I went to see a woman about a rash on her arm, and medically speaking, it was about the simplest thing you could imagine. But after I looked at her rash and I was getting ready to go, she took a hold of me and pulled me down close to her and said, I'm so lonely. And I realized just even in that moment that I had nothing to offer and that my education had nothing to offer. And I went back to the nurse's station and I wrote an order for a cream and I went home and I just couldn't escape this truth that she had spoken to me. And I opened my eyes to the loneliness in long-term care and I decided to commit my life to changing that and to creating a different vision of aging and of care that actually would eradicate loneliness. So that was 20-some years ago, and I've been on this journey ever since and been very happy, a very happy warrior against loneliness.
So what do you do? Tell us what the Eden Alternative actually does.
Well, what it does is it's a nonprofit organization that teaches people how to think and behave differently regarding care and caregiving.
Like what? Give us an example.
Here's a simple thing we teach to people who operate nursing homes. We say to people who operate nursing homes, if you want to know how the staff is treating the elders, if you want to answer that question, how are these staff members treating these elders? All you have to do is look at how the management treats the staff. Because the staff will treat the elders the way the management treats the staff. And when, boy, believe me, when I speak those words, light bulbs go on and people are like, oh, yeah, we are not treating our staff the way we want them to treat the elders. So we do that kind of teaching. We coach people and teach people new language and new approaches and new insights to help them change the nature of long-term care. The other thing we do is work with family members who are in family caregiving situations and help them escape from some of the worst aspects of caregiving as a concept, the way we use it here in the United States.
And so help me understand that. So the Eden Alternative is helping the long-term care facilities mm-hmm. raise the bar. They're helping them look at within yep. themselves and learn how to do better with a different approach.
Yep. If you want to imagine a picture of me, I know we're on radio. You got to imagine a guy with a beard and a baseball cap on and a whistle, just like the coach in high school team. And I'm out on the field whistling and telling the folks in long-term care, hey, gather around. Here's the plan. Here's what we're going to do. And I teach and I coach, trying to help people, as you said, raise the bar on their performance.
And what's happening from that?
Well, actually, an idea that started in one nursing home 20 years ago is now spread all over the world. Japan, Singapore, Australia, Sweden, Switzerland, UK, Ireland. We're all over the world. And what's interesting is, even though the systems of care are different all over the world, the problems are the same. This loneliness problem is the same in Sweden as it is here. Even though the systems are very different.
You know, I'm looking at the growing epidemic, the kind of fear that we all have of aging and dementia. How do you tackle this issue of loneliness, both for the person who ages with dementia, but also for the family that is so often isolated?
Yeah. Actually, that's picking up on a really important point. And we actually are also critical of the idea of caregiving representing a two-person relationship. There's the caregiver and the person being cared for. We think that model is very dangerous, very isolating, both for the elder and the caregiver, and risky, frankly. And so we teach people a different approach called care partnering. And in this model, and I'm talking about families living at home, in this model, there's a care partner team. The elder is on the care partner team, is a full member of the team. And the care partner team includes, for example, you guys, the physicians, and you include nurses and people who support and help and friends. And you strive to create a community of support rather than saying to the caregiver, that's it, you're responsible, you're on the hook, you're the one who's taking care of mom. We teach a different approach, much more collaborative, much more communal, much more shared, and the elder is a full partner.
We love it. I can tell you that.
So what you're doing and what you've been working on for the last 20, however many years, is changing the paradigm of aging. It's changing the paradigm of long-term care giving, both in facilities and in the home. And you're doing it globally. How do you set your goals for the vision of what you're actually trying to change? And how will you know that you've reached it?
Well, I actually think I know what the problem is. The problem is, in American society, we equate aging with decline. When we say somebody's aged, we mean that person has declined.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually see aging as a very complicated, very poorly understood process of human development. So I call aging late life development. And how do I measure my success? How do I know if I'm moving in the right direction? The more people shift their perspective from seeing aging exclusively as decline and seeing aging as a time of growth and change and challenge and difficulty, all mixed up, to the degree we can make that switch, we can solve the most extraordinary problem.
You know, it sounds almost like you're a parent with teenagers. But this challenge, this challenge of maintaining relationships. I'm going to ask you two questions, short ones. How do they impact, if not any of the work? Social media on one hand, pets on the other. How do they
social
work?
Social media. Well, social media is a great way to connect and communicate, especially for people with unpopular ideas like mine. So, you know, there's never going to be a TV show about the virtues of egging, okay? That's not what they do. They celebrate youth. So social media allows me to communicate. I have a blog called Changing Aging, and I'm on Twitter, Dr. Bill Thomas. But it allows me to communicate directly with people who are interested, and I love it. Really fun. And then you're talking about pets. Pets are a four-lane highway companionship. They can be the most terrific, loyal, and supportive companions for people of all ages, but actually especially for older people.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Thomas, begun a fascinating conversation. Where can our listeners go to learn about your most recent book and potentially to learn about resources for them or rethinking this whole vision of aging?
I'll just give readers two quick things to think about. One, I wrote a book about this part of life called Second Wind, helping you catch your second wind in life. And I've developed a website called LifeReimagined.org.
LifeReimagined.org.
Yeah, and both of those are designed to help people imagine what's next. And I think that's a crucial and underappreciated part of it.
Well, we'll be sure to link that on our blog as well.
And I must say that your conversation with the 93-year-old woman that you mentioned earlier in our show, I do think you gave her something which is maybe not recognized, is you gave her yourself. And that perhaps is a key ingredient to a lot of what you're talking about, is being there so that you're not experiencing whatever it is that is happening to you by yourself.
Yeah, being present.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And we really want to thank you for giving us time today and giving the listeners of your health time. This is a great beginning to a conversation that I think is a growing one and important one across the world. And thank you for all the work you've done.
Good.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas.
You guys. Thanks for having me on, and good luck with the show.
Thank you. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
We've got good questions today, Adam.
We do. We're going to be talking about who should get a pneumococcal vaccination?
About herpes and questions, private questions from your doctor.
About, you know, colon cancer, and are you at risk if someone else in your family's had it?
And about winter, depression, or feeling low.
Well, let's ask our great executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first house call.
I'm a 50-year-old diabetic, and my disease is well controlled. My doctor recently said that in addition to the flu shot, I also need to have the pneumonia shot. I thought this was only for older people or those that are really sick. Will this help me?
We appreciate you raising that, because it's true that patients who have a chronic illness and diabetes would fall in that category, even if it's well controlled. It is recommended that you get a pneumonia shot. It gets extra confusing because there are a couple different types of pneumonia shot. But yes, it will reduce your chance of getting pneumonia, which is that infection in your lungs that can make you really sick.
And those people who are at risk include those who are over the age of 65, but a whole host of conditions. If you have chronic lung condition of any sort, if you have a chronic heart condition of almost any sort, and then things that lower your immune response, maybe multiple sclerosis or diabetes in this case, or other sorts of immune problems, then you're at higher risk of what's called this invasive pneumonia, which is a killer of a lot of people. And so the question is, will you benefit? Well, we can't say at the individual level will you benefit, but we can say these are the recommendations of the Centers for Disease Control, and you should get this. And we'll cover it a different show, Christy, about the different types of pneumococcal vaccinations, because that has changed. But you should definitely talk with your doctor about it.
Yeah, and it's a good resource to think about going for the Center for Disease Control, cdc.gov. And you can just look up in the search box pneumonia vaccine, and you'll get some information sheets that'll sort of give you the basics about why it's important.
Thank you so much for your question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm in my 70s and recently went to see my doctor with pain in my lower abdomen, including my private areas. He asked if I'd had any blisters or if I'd ever had herpes. I told him that I haven't been sexually active in over a decade, and I was initially offended. But then he said I could have been exposed to herpes a decade ago when I was sexually active. If he didn't ask, he would have never been able to make a diagnosis. When he explained it, that made way more sense.
Well, I bet that this is not an easy conversation for both a lot of doctors and a lot of patients. And sometimes I wonder if we avoid conversations because they're hard.
It's true. And in this case, you were offended by any assumptions or that the doctor would even consider that you might have herpes or have a sexually transmitted disease. But yet, if we as doctors just make assumptions about patients and don't ask the questions, then we miss things a lot. And it's a natural human tendency to make some assumptions. But I think this says a lot about your doctor that he asked the questions as he would anyone.
Yeah, I have patients, Christy, in their 80s who've been on anti-herpes medications for 30, 40 years. You know, they've been on something. And so it's less rare than we think, and it doesn't imply any value judgment. So I really applaud this kind of discovery and this openness. I think it's the type of model we should have, and you should feel free to talk with your doctor about your concerns, and the doctor can at least ask the questions that they're concerned about.
Right. I applaud you as a patient for sort of acknowledging to your doctor that you were offended by it so that you could have the explanation for why it was important. A really good job, and thank you for sharing it. Let's take our next house call question.
Both my father and my aunt were diagnosed with colon cancer 6 months apart. I know this is a common cancer, but I'm 45 and wonder if I should go ahead and have testing done due to my family history.
The short answer is yes.
Yes.
I mean, that, you know, that's the short answer. But I think there's more to it than that for this. And I'm sorry that your father and aunt were diagnosed, you know, at young ages.
And sometimes when you have, especially two people who were diagnosed 6 months apart, when you have that kind of family history and you have your own processing of their diagnoses, but also your own concern and worry of yourself. A lot of times, if you share that with your doctor or share that with the scheduler of the colonoscopy, they'll help you get it done a little bit more quickly, just to give you that peace of mind. And based on that family history, when they take the details and based on what they find, they might suggest having your colonoscopy done more often for surveillance, since you are at higher risk if those were blood relatives, both with colon cancer.
One way of looking at this is the fact, you know, how many relatives have you had diagnosed with colon cancer? And Christy, I had some patients recently who, you know, once I found out that one of the members had it, and then I had the second one screened, and the second one had it, and then, you know, we really worked to get that third one in, and, you know, all three had colon cancer. And the simple fact is, if you have more than one relative with colorectal cancer, you have a 4.5 times lifetime increased risk of developing that. That's a huge risk. And if you've had a relative that's been diagnosed with it less than age 45, you have a 3.5 times increased risk. So, you know, there's a strong genetic component to this that is really important to pay attention to.
And the beautiful thing about the colonoscopy, no one wants to have it done, but it's a great thing that they can often detect those cancers before they even become cancer and remove it, and then it's never a problem for you. So we both sounds like support you going ahead and getting that done.
Erica, what's our very last house call?
In the winter, I usually start to feel a little down and perhaps depressed for many reasons. I exercise, eat well, and get plenty of sleep. Other than taking antidepressants or moving to Florida, what else can I do?
I would definitely take a vacation to Florida.
Sounds good.
And take Christy and I with you.
Yeah, as your consultants.
You know, I think this is such a problem for so many people. First off, I myself don't really like winters. I don't like the coldness. I don't like the short days and the darkness. So, you know, sometimes I've heard of people, and we have research on using bright lights, be exposed to, you know, 15 minutes to an hour of really bright light, particularly in the morning. That can help.
Yeah, there are these things called light boxes that you can get and have either at your work or at your home or both that can make an impact. The other aspect are thinking about planned outings or planned connectiveness, as we were talking about earlier, to try to reach out and make friends and increase the number of people coming into that funnel, if you were listening to our earlier conversation. And thinking about when you said you were depressed for many reasons, what are those reasons? And are some of those things that you could talk to a counselor about? Is there another element beyond antidepressants and moving to Florida that you can do to change things?
Great advice, Christy. Well, we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important, and you can share your questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu and visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Bill Thomas. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.